Welcome to Steel Stories by US Steel. In this podcast, we explore the wealth of knowledge from leading industry experts to help you navigate the infinitely developing, renewable world of steel.
Welcome to Steel Stories. I'm your host, David Kirkpatrick. And today, we're going to dive into some of the issues around sustainability and climate action in the steel industry that you might not have really thought much about. It turns out the steel industry is a very complicated place, and there are a lot of things that you can do to change its environmental footprint. And today, what we're going to learn about is locomotives in steel plants and how they are changing as they go electric. So that's a pretty cool thing, and there's a lot to say about it. So let's dive right in with our two guests. Neil Perger is project manager at US Steel, who has been deeply involved in this project. And Mike Nicoletti is a partner at IRT, which is the company that builds the electric engines for the trains. So we'll hear from both of them at some length. But let me start by asking you, Neil, just to tell us what it is that happened at US Steel in the Mon Valley and what it means.
David, thank you for having me. And so I'm a project manager at the Mon Valley here. It's outside of Pittsburgh, the US Steel facility at Edgar Thompson plant in Braddock. It's not just what's happened, it's what's been happening for the last really 100 years is always looking to improve. And the focus has always been the process. How is the steelmaking process affecting the air, the water, the waste streams? And here we look beyond that, and it was the transportation modes for the steelmaking process, for the raw materials, all the interplant moves. So we always have eyes on our plant. We have our own eyes on our plant more than anybody. And if you look around the landscape, you will see locomotives operating at the Edgar Thompson facility in Braddock. We own 8 locomotives that we run our raw materials throughout the plant. We run our hot metal up to our melt shop from the blast furnaces, the molten iron to the steel shop. We have at Clairton, we move the coke from coming off the batteries and the screening station out to the main line where it can be transported on the main line. So these moves are happening every day around the clock, and locomotives, diesel operated, they're big diesel engine from the 1950s that they were acquired. So they're obviously not the cleanest machines, but not a lot of technologies. They're starting to emerge now, but we never had off-the-shelf solutions for that. Here we are. I'll hand it over to Mike here in a second, where IRT, Innovative Rail Technologies, here they come with their propulsion system, taking a diesel engine and converting it to all electric, zero emissions. That combined with the opportunity from the state of PA with their funding opportunity. So Mike can take us back to 3 years ago when IRT approached US Steel and said, we have an idea for you. We have an opportunity. There's funding. We have a solution. It's new. It hasn't been done, but here we are. Let's partner up and do this. So Mike.
So for us at IRT, as you said, we were a new company then. We're still, I would classify us more as an early maturing stage company now. But at the time, we came together as a core team from the rail sector, from the lithium ion sector, from the government relations sector to pursue modernizing locomotives, which myself being the railroader, from my viewpoint, has been done incrementally over the decades, but never really to such a sizable change. And so we were very much strategizing and trying to decide who would be an ideal launch customer, who would fit a really good profile, be a perfect test case for lithium ion propulsion onto itself. And we happened to come across a posting for US EPA funding, and it was national funding, and they were supplying it to about a dozen counties. And in my past, I'm in the Chicago area. I'd been on property at Geary Works when I worked in the rail side of the industry. I was familiar with US Steel from that. And as soon as I saw Allegheny County on the list, I immediately said to my partners, that's US Steel. That's the one that makes sense. Everything about it fits and makes sense. And maybe we can get an audience with them and maybe they'll take to the idea. And thankfully for us at IRT, the U.S. Steel team took to it instantly. And we were really, I think, a good team with the concept. And so it was very much amazing and unbelievable to see the U.S. Steel management team grab on so quickly to the idea and embrace it and want to run with it. And really, that's how we got started.
That's very cool. So a couple things. Neil, how much track is there in these various plants? And how far do these things have to travel? It's not 100 miles. It's like a couple miles at most, right?
Yeah. Each plant is a couple miles. But to be honest, we quantified it in gallons of diesel. How many gallons of diesel are we consuming a day? And this is an energy benefit for us and the community. It's not a huge moneymaker thing. It's not, oh my gosh, I'm spending too much on diesel. How do I wean myself from diesel and save a lot of money? And we'll talk more about that as we go, of course. But yeah, to give the ballpark, it's a mile or two.
How much diesel were you using in a day?
So at ET?
First of all, tell the listeners what ET is. There's two different plants we're talking about. ET is what?
So Edgar Thompson plant is the primary steel producer. So we have blast furnaces producing pure iron. That pure iron is made by the coke from Clairton. And that iron goes to our melt shop at the BOP, basic oxygen process, converts that, combines it with scrap to make the steel, and does the alloying processes, and then casts it into 8-inch slabs to be processed at Irvin Works at the rolling mills. And then Clairton Works at Clairton has the coke batteries where they produce the coke to fuel the blast furnaces all over the country. So that's our basic footprint here in the Mullen Valley. So how much diesel per year? 24,000 gallons of diesel per year for the ET loco.
You mean per locomotive? Each locomotive?
That's for the ET locomotive. The Clairton facility, it's 16,000 gallons per year.
That's a lot of diesel.
So that those duty cycles, that diesel consumption, that all goes in the calculator. Mike is really, you know, the guru for looking at the quantifier benchmarks and then coming up with our, we feel is a good estimate for PM 2.5 emission savings, carbon emission savings.
So just to give everybody an idea of what that means, if you take a, what I would refer to as a legacy locomotive, such as what U.S. Steel is operating and we're replacing with the electric units, unit of measure they call grams per brake horsepower hour is what the EPA simplifies that down to. And what that means is whether it is an on-road truck, a refuse truck, a bus, or a locomotive, grams per brake horsepower hour is the way to make everything apples to apples in the same. And on that unit of measure, just as an example, NOx, NOx emissions, is about 17 to 18 grams per brake horsepower hour. For say a circa 1950s to 1960s locomotive. And comparatively speaking, NOx is almost non-existent in a modern vehicle. So there's a tremendous benefit to electrifying older assets.
Well, that was one of the things I was going to ask you is why electric? I mean, maybe people understand, hey, the Teslas don't pollute and all that, but just give us a little bit of the case for electricity in this industry.
Sure. So from a use case perspective, all of these, any new technology that has emerged in locomotives has always started in a localized environment. And that is just due to technology's capabilities, due to supply chain, all, you know, all those kind of myriad of factors. But the benefit to the end user, in this case, U.S. Steel, is a drastic reduction of emissions from the locomotive. But peeling the onion back a little bit beyond that, what is really transformational about our technology, innovative rail technologies and lithium ion propulsion, is the ability to build in redundancies, such as if you think of a conventional diesel powered locomotive, if the engine portion of it goes bad, the engine is down. In an electric locomotive, at least an IRT design, if we, for the sake of this, say a battery has an issue, then the locomotive simply takes it offline and continues to operate. And so there are some actual very sizable operational changes and benefits that comes with this new technology. And that's something that really, from my perspective, that the rail industry has not ever had before. And so it's environmental, it's operational. And at the end of the day, what it should lead to for U.S. Steel is, I believe, the opportunity for increased and steady throughput.
That's cool. Well, you know, I want to, in a minute, look at the entire U.S. rail industry and the role electricity is playing there and how this fits into all that. But I want to go back to you, Neil, for a second with a big question about this whole project. I mean, it's really cool that U.S. Steel agreed to basically be a guinea pig, so to speak, to be the first customer for a major new technology, which is, I think, a huge feather in your cap. What led to the company thinking that was a good idea and being willing to take a chance on a new technology? And what does that say about the company's attitude towards the whole sustainability journey?
It's the commitment of leadership. And really, we know we need to think outside the box to achieve our goals for carbon emissions. This is just another piece. And there we've been doing so many things, like I said, over the last 100 years. Every year, we got to think of, okay, what do we have to do now? So over the last 10 years, our air quality in the Mon Valley has improved by 80%. So we're really proud of that. Those strides have been happening much faster. And again, this is just another piece. We know everybody understands it from the top down. So big credit to our leadership here at the Mon Valley.
Sounds like there must have already been quite a willingness to like think outside the box, as you put it, that there was such an incredible welcome attitude as soon as Mike and his colleagues first brought this idea to you. So you were already trying to figure out new ways to address those two issues, I would assume.
Sure. Like I said, from the top down, the whole organization is, if it's financially feasible, obviously that's not a component of it. Yeah, David, we're always looking proactively to how can we improve any way possible our operations. And yeah, this wasn't even something that was on the radar, but we kind of knew that because nothing had been done like this. So
as I think is known, but U.S. Steel procured or was awarded Pennsylvania Department of Environmental Protection Volkswagen Fund, which basically means, in short, Volkswagen got in trouble for misleading people on emissions, let's just say.
Yeah, diesel emissions, ironically, which is what we're talking about here.
Right. They called it Dieselgate, right? And so there were large amounts of trust fund for every single state in the union that went in, and Pennsylvania had the funds available. And when we first, meaning Innovative Rail Technologies, first approached the Pennsylvania DEP to find out if this was eligible, and we said it's for a zero emission locomotive, and the response we actually had from DEP was, gosh, it should be, but the way we wrote our plan, we didn't even think that this was possible. And so we actually worked with US EPA to get US EPA to work with the state EPA to come up with language to basically change their solicitation. Because as we said, if U.S. Steel applies for a zero emission locomotive that's electrified, you don't actually have a way to fund it. And so they had to change their program. They were so excited about the concept and something like this happening.
Well, this is a good time maybe to step back and look at the railroad industry more broadly, because one of the reasons they probably didn't have that in their state regulations was that they didn't even think about electrifying diesel locomotives because it hasn't been done much. I mean, although in other countries it has. And talk a little bit about what does diesel powers most of U.S. freight, right? But how do you see this in the context of the evolution of the industry? How much electricity is used in American railroading now? And how do you see the breakdown of the industry in terms of where this technology may be pertinent?
So if you look at Europe as a contrast to us, a comparison to us, they are heavily electrified with overhead wire, but they also are not banning from the Atlantic to the Pacific Ocean. As I'd mentioned earlier, where battery will get a hold is really first going to be in operation, say 100 miles or less. And how that will plant its flag technologically in the industry is what in time will really push zero emission type efforts, I think, with greater intensity onto what we refer to as line haul.
So it's a long haul, what we would think of as long haul, called line haul in the industry.
That's correct, yes. And so we are asked from time to time by various organizations, private or public, about can we electrify locomotives or a train and have it go from, say, Chicago to San Francisco? And, you know, we always answer them very truthfully, which is no. But what we can do to get zero emissions and to help the localized communities is this right now. So I think that, as we brought up before, everything always starts in the yards and locally. And there will be more technologies that will emerge to complement battery to really drive the industry more towards zero. I would suggest to look at the industry really like this. We really have localized service, like what U.S. Steel is, and then we have really that line haul long distance service. And they're almost like two different networks unto themselves that just happen to be both in the rail industry.
And how many locomotives are we talking about in those two sectors?
So in the U.S. and Canada, there are a little bit more than 40,000 locomotives. And of the local regional type, which are sometimes called switcher locomotives, regional operations, there are about 10,000 to 13,000.
So those are the ones that you can target with your technology, pretty much almost all of those.
That's correct. Yeah.
And just quickly, the way you do it, you build a new electric engine powered by lithium ion batteries, and you're able to swap it out for the diesel engine that's already in the locomotive. You're not building new locomotives, am I right?
Correct. So we are taking an existing frame, something that is very different about the rail industry versus other modes of transportation is that think of the frame of the locomotive, the wheels, which we call the trucks in the industry, they, except for metal fatigue, they do not expire. There's no regulation. There's nothing about operating them indefinitely. There's sometimes a joke in the industry that if you acquire a locomotive and it has less than 1 million hours on it, it hasn't been broken in yet. And so as a result of that, we're able to take these very good cores and we're able to rebuild them and deliver them to customers, whether it's the customer's own unit, which is what the ET5E locomotive will be, or something that is new, which is what the first Clairton unit is, which was new. One other thing that I would highlight to think about is one of the other benefits of this is a really big buzzword is increasingly the circular economy. And a big circular economy boost of repowering these old but yet great assets is that we get to keep everything that's good and we get to bring them to zero emissions to complement it.
That's super cool. I didn't know that at all, but it makes sense. In fact, I saw the video of this new locomotive running around at U.S. Steel. It looked brand new, but I guess that's just because it was just repainted along with getting a new engine, right?
Yeah. It still looks good out there.
It still looks good. I'm sure it does, Neil. I would never badmouth your locomotives. If you're interested in seeing that video, check the episode notes because we will include that there. Well, I love the idea that there's this huge segment, but people haven't really thought about electrifying it much though, right? I mean, I think one thing you told me as we were prepping, Mike, was that there has been very little pressure on the railroad industry generally to kind of decarbonize, and you guys are coming in with this innovative technology and it's going to possibly catalyze a lot of change, but people haven't really been thinking this way enough in this industry, right?
Yeah, you know, we are rail and steel, we're really old guard. And so it takes a lot of dedication and a lot of effort and willingness to change. And I want to say on the highlight again of U.S. Steel for us being our launch customer, how great I really think that is. Because of that, I think these two old guard industries of America coming together to bring technology forward. And I think it's a really historically fitting match that way. And as far as it goes for where the technology goes from there, I just think that it's a good blueprint that's being laid down here. And it's something I will say that the interest over the years and over the past year that we see from a rail standpoint is intensifying greatly. Interest is intensifying greatly from various states and agencies. And I'm sure that at U.S. Steel would kind of have a little bit of a laugh about how much the interest has intensified in their own sector upon information coming out about this. And it's been pretty remarkable.
I mean, just you guys doing this together is causing a lot of discussion in the industry.
On our side at IRT, absolutely.
That's so cool. That's really great. How old is IRT? Well, give us a quick summary of this company.
So we officially formed in 2019. And then, of course, there was COVID. And here we are. And so we persevered through that. And we're fortunate enough to find U.S. Steel in that time period to bring the vision.
Did you have to invent a especially new kind of electric engine, or were the components basically out there and you're basically repurposing them for this application?
So the term that we best use is best available technology. So one of the best things to do here as we're breaking this sector and trying to be disruptive is to not try and reinvent the wheel any more than it needs to. And the good news was that we could look to existing technologies and products. And then really for us, the effort went into how to package it properly, how to package it safely, of course, and then how to control it and how to control everything to work together harmoniously and one integrated design that was easy to install, easy to understand, and easy to maintain over time.
So that's really where your intellectual property comes, is sort of in the systems design and the software and all that stuff.
Correct.
Yeah.
Everything in the cab, everything really looks the same for the operator. Like you said, everything below the chassis is exactly the same for operators and mechanics, for the exception of an absence of a fuel tank, obviously. But when you talk about lithium ion batteries, the batteries, oh my gosh, there's fire, there's unknowns. These are sealed, state of the art. We have temperature monitoring in how many thermocouples do we have in every battery? Like three.
I think there's six in every pack.
Six. Thank you. And every battery, there's 10 batteries on the Claritin unit and there's 15 on the ET unit. There's ambient temperature monitoring, there's system temperatures, there's cooling systems as we see weather extremes. So it really is truly state of the art.
Well, it's one of the good things about electrical systems versus internal combustion ones is that they can really be remotely monitored much more thoroughly in a way that we need and will also ensure they keep operating. But I want to go, Neil, to a bigger question about how you guys have dealt with this internally. I mean, change is hard, right? This is something fundamentally new. You said that the drivers or the engineers, as we like to think of them, you know, driving the trains, they seem to have made a fairly smooth switch into these. But did this kind of a change like cause a little disruption inside the organization? Was there some resistance? Talk a little bit about the process of introducing something fundamentally new like this.
Very little, actually. I give credit to our guys. I think there was some apprehension of the unknown, but it was just simply the unknown of, I don't know what this is going to really look like. But there was a lot of transparency with us, IRT, as it was being built, as the design was evolving. It was the first. But again, credit to our guys. They asked a lot of questions and IRT was right there putting their mind at ease as we went through the process. And as they were building it, we brought US Steel people down to Georgia where it was built in their facility. Hey, do a ride along. What do you like? What do you don't like? What's the feedback? Obviously, IRT has done and will do everything in its power to satisfy all of our needs and, you know, even operator kind of preferences of, hey, this light could be brighter. Everything from that to this chair doesn't give me enough room. So we're working through those little things.
Well, those are important things. I mean, those are the little things that can make or break a new system. So I didn't realize until just listening to you now, there's really sort of some collaborative innovation that happened here in the development of these systems, given that US Steel was the first customer. Mike, is that the way you think of it? That once they kind of engaged, you were able to learn how to make the better product faster?
Yeah, I mean, feedback is critical. I probably say to Neil way too many times, we're going to be around. But I think hopefully that is becoming very apparent. For me personally, prior to IRT, coming from the rail side of the industry, having run departments that was in charge of locomotive, fleets of locomotives and rail car maintenance and et cetera, I lived through a lot of deployments of new locomotives where the vendor sold the unit, dropped off the keys and said, don't call me ever again, was kind of implied. And it always left such a bitter taste in my mouth. And so as we went into this, what was great about our team at IRT is there was a universal understanding that that was not who we were going to be. And that as we engaged with customers, it had to be holistic. We had to be there. We had to be on site when needed. And we had to be responsive, and we have to take that very seriously too, because again, these are our initial deployments. So there's a lot of collaboration that's required. There's feedback that's required. And I feel like every time I'm out there, I probably ask a million times to anybody I get a hold of, what do you have to tell me? Tell me something, tell me anything, because I'm eager to hear what it is. I love it when it's good, but sometimes it's not so great either. And that's okay too. Those are things that we want to know, we want to understand. And at the end of the day, I want to be able to visit the property 4, 6, 8, the batteries will have a life of 12 years. I would like to be on the property 12 years from now and still seeing it in service and see it doing its job. And that to me is a great thing.
Yeah, it's great listening to you because, you know, we don't think of, you know, sort of tech entrepreneurship coming out of things like the railroad industry. And here you are, a professional railroad guy who's like got the mindset of a Silicon Valley entrepreneur trying to figure out how to iterate and customer satisfaction was a fundamentally new system. I think it's just really cool. So you're saying the employees at U.S. Steel liked it. I mean, obviously, I would think if I worked around there, I would be happy because it's going to be less pollution even where I'm working there, right?
Right. Then, like I said, everybody's been great communicating. We definitely understand the responsibility that we have with making sure that it is a reliable machine, that issues are taken care of right away.
On the other side, if you look at the Edgar Thompson, where I think the collaboration has been great too, is I've heard from multiple individuals talking about ET, and there they have what is referred to as the Mixer Hill run going up to 4.5 degree elevation with the Lidl cars. And I heard time and time again, will it do the Mixer Hill run? Because that's the hardest run we have. Can this pull that off and do it? We're going to see if it can do it.
You mean a heavy load going up a hill?
It is. And to me, I thought that's fantastic. Because if you don't give us your hardest challenges, then forever the equipment kind of becomes a sideshow. Let's hark it over there, have it do that side job. And that's really not what we hope for. We hope to be challenged and we hope to be put to the test that way. And so for the Edgar Thompson Mixer Hill run and to have the opportunity to do that and to prove out the equipment and to prove out its capabilities with U.S. Steel is great.
Wait, how long does it last?
So we have, and this is based on running what we've seen over the last few weeks. We did go a whole weekend on one charge for the Clarion operation. It's about 2 to 3 days based on our operation.
That's a long time for a locomotive.
And again, it's not full horsepower all day, every day. Okay, so it moves and then it's able to go on charge for what we call an opportunity charge.
Yeah. One of the things that I wanted to just make sure people understand, because I know both of you, you told me that people sometimes say, oh yeah, well, what difference does electricity make if it's being powered by some remote coal plant or something else? Just address that critique. I don't know what the source of your power is, but I know that that question is fundamentally misinformed. So explain why it's valuable to go from diesel to electric.
So I think that what is commonly missed there is what gets referred to as point of source emissions. In mass, let's just talk about all the locomotives in the U.S. And all of those locomotives, if they're electric, if they're getting towards zero emissions, the benefits for the communities that are local to that at that point of source are very real. And to say that and to put it off, which we all see from time to time in the news about, yeah, but it's coming from a coal plant, so who cares? Well, everybody across all sectors is incrementally and steadily becoming cleaner and cleaner. And so why should any one asset, why should any one aspect of an operation be exempted simply from a defeatist attitude of saying, yeah, but it's all coming from coal or it's FS, who cares? It ignores that responsibility to do that we can and will building. It's every little will.
But there is a physics answer too, right? I mean, the physics answer is actually far more of the energy from electricity is transferred into propulsion than when you burn a fuel. So you're getting, even if you're using coal-powered plant to charge the batteries at night, when you actually are running the device, you're getting dramatically more efficiency out of that power than you would if you were putting fuel in the engine.
Correct. So that is a great point and follow-on to that. So the electric drive system in the Clairton unit and the Edgar Thompson unit will be 99.x% efficient, which is basically a good way of saying virtually every drop of energy that goes into that locomotive is being used productively and is not being wasted. Whereas if you fill your diesel tank, if you fill your gasoline tank in your car, your tailpipe emissions are very much real heat and real energy that is lost, and that efficiency can never be regained.
And the efficiency of a diesel or a gas engine is like under 25%, isn't it?
It's what it's posted for the legacy engines in these locomotives is right around 30%.
30%. Okay. So we're talking from 30% efficiency going up to 99% efficiency. So that really, to me, dismisses. And quickly, Mike, here's another thing I had wanted to ask you. What other kind of customers do you have?
We're working with a tourist train, actually, to wholly electrify their run, which will be very neat as they operate inside a U.S. national park. We're working with a handful of U.S. ports and port adjacent short line type operations. So we like to stick to the mantra of if we can get you to zero emissions and you have that 800 miles or less range that I mentioned earlier, that's where we're ready to make the technology succeed. Industrial wise, we also see agricultural corporations. So there's kind of a lot of interest across the board in all of those types of sectors.
I assume, Neil, that U.S. Steel's looking for other ways to reduce emissions. Are there any other interesting, unexpected ways, aside from just like making steel with electricity like you do in other parts of your company? Are there other sort of possible avenues that you guys have thought about where you could like reduce emissions in unexpected ways? Give a couple of examples of things that might happen down the road.
Sure. More electric vehicles, just like this one, but it could be smaller scale, it could be larger scale. Thinking outside the box. And so as a project as simple as containment and dust collection, and projects as large as new facilities, Big River Steel is producing the net zero steel product.
Which is another part of U.S. Steel's operation.
Yeah, that's right. So in collaboration with our local agencies, we have AI technology that looks at the weather, looks at any temperature, potential temperature inversions, and we proactively take action in our plants and our operations.
And save energy in the process and emissions.
Yeah, especially emissions. So that's been a huge success using technology all over the map.
Well, I would also ask either one of you if there's anything that I should have asked you that I didn't. You want to just make sure you mentioned that you were hoping to talk about. Anything, Mike, from you that you had hoped to get in here that we didn't discuss?
For me, the biggest thing that I would want to add is, one, I appreciate the opportunity to talk today and talk about this collaboration and basically, you know, how thrilled we were to have the opportunity to work with U.S. Steel. And as I always say, we'll continue to be around. So if people on property see myself or any of my colleagues from IRT and you want to pull us to the side and pepper us with questions and say anything you want to say or ask any questions, I always encourage that. Feel free to do it. I know the things that are new are sometimes a little bit overwhelming, and anything that we can do to help out with that, I think we'll continue to do and to support you guys any way that we can.
Terrific. Thanks, Mike. Neil, anything that you wanted to add that we didn't discuss?
Yeah, thank you. Just piggybacking what Mike said, yeah, I expect to be here. I tell everybody, oh, I got 30 more years to work, so I want to be here. So the sustainability is beyond just what U.S. Steel is asking of us. It's personal for me. So whenever there's a problem with Loco, I always say, you know where to find me. So I was just proud to be a part of it.
Well, thank you so much, both of you, Mike and Neil. And thank you to our listeners. But please join us again or for another episode soon of Steel Stories. This has been a great conversation. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Steel Stories is brought to you by U.S. Steel. To find out more about our sustainable steel solutions and how our Best for All strategy allows us to re-envision the future alongside our customers, visit www.ussteel.com. Search for U.S. Steel in Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Podcasts, or anywhere else podcasts are found. And make sure to hit subscribe so you never miss a future episode. On behalf of the team here at U.S. Steel, thanks for listening.